Agenda. We're going to start with Alan. Alan, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Ramona. Great to chat again.
Yes. So let's start by having you tell us about Clipfolio and what do you do? What is the business?
Sure. So I'll give you a very brief intro into Clipfolio. So we're a cloud-based real-time dashboard vendor. We're very fortunate in that we have probably about 8,000 customers globally who are now monitoring their business in real time. So these are mostly small and mid-sized companies, and really for you know, every department, every team, and every company, it is so important to understand what's working in the company and what is not working in the company. So we're big believers of being able to monitor your performance and then making decisions accordingly. So we're very fortunate in that we have close to almost over 8,000 customers today that are doing exactly that. So the company's been around for a long time, and I am the founder and the current CEO.
So you started a while ago. When and how did you start? What was the, you know, what spurred you to start this company?
Sure. So we started with a passion around being able to better monitor frequently changing data. And the way that started was actually not in the business sphere, but it was in the consumer space. So the idea was there has to be a better way to monitor news or weather or your stocks or your sports scores. So the company actually started as a consumer dashboard that mm-hmm. would allow you to monitor all these various things on a little dashboard and do so in real time. So you didn't have to go to every single website and look at these various tidbits of information. So that
what
was,
year was
that? Was Genesis. Go ahead.
What year was that?
That was 2001. So that was a long, long time ago. And I think
long,
we launched the application. Yeah, we launched the application in 2002. And keep in mind, this is now, it's not cloud. This is a Windows downloadable piece of software. So it's very different than what it is today.
So your first enterprise deal came in 2004, which was
yes.
3 years after you started with the consumer concept, and it was a real stroke of luck. So tell us what happened and what gave you the clue into the fact that it could be that the real meat of the business is in the enterprise.
So when we were working with all of these consumers, we actually saw wild success. So we had upwards of 1,000 downloads of our dashboard on a daily basis. And again, this is to consumers. But we really struggled in trying to make a business model, a profitable business model work. The idea was that the publishers of this data were going to be our customers and that the consumers was sort of the demand of the marketplace, but that didn't really work. Nonetheless, we had upwards of 300,000 users of our dashboard, and of course, many of those users worked at companies. So it was in 2004 that a large international airline came to us and they said, hey, we love your personal dashboard, but could we actually push business metrics through this, as opposed to sports scores and soccer scores in the news?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that was a real moment in the history of the company. And all of a sudden, we went from monitoring personal data to being able to monitor metrics that meant the best decisions. We had to monitor these metrics for a business context. So overnight, the company shifted from a consumer tool to a business tool. And all of a sudden, we found that it wasn't just this airline, but we started selling into other enterprise companies. So there was a real need for a real-time dashboard that would better tell folks how they were performing from a business point of view on a daily basis.
And there was nothing like that in the market at the time, which explains why they came to you and asked you to customize
Correct.
This for them?
Correct. So for anybody that knows the business intelligence space, you'll know that it's very crowded. And even back then in 2004, there was lots of...
It was still very crowded.
Say again?
It was still very crowded.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
It was still very crowded.
It was, and it is still crowded. But there was MicroStrategy, there was Cognos, there was SAP with Business Object. So all of our customers have these tools, but these tools didn't lend themselves for real-time visibility of what was happening. And so that was our real niche, and we were consistent in the way we applied that to the consumer space. And then we were also consistent in the way we applied that to the business space. So this idea of real-time monitoring was something that was of huge value and nobody was doing yet.
So did this enterprise model replicate itself? How did you manage to go from that one customer telling you that this is what they want, and then you obviously had to make quite a bit of modification on the product? And then how did you pivot, so to speak, to the enterprise business?
So the pivot itself wasn't very difficult. You'll know this as well, but if you're making next to no money and all of a sudden there's a customer that is willing to pay you, you pivot pretty quickly. I think The struggle then came in that we had to scale this new business. So now that we had an enterprise customer, we really had to figure out how do we get from one customer to 10 customers to 100 customers. And we did that, although it really took a lot of time. So we were selling into IT, we were selling through procurement, and as you mentioned, every customer, because these were relatively large deals, they were sort of between 25K and 200K per customer. A lot of them had a lot of customization of the code. And that's one of the dangers. If you have few customers and the customers are paying you a relatively sizable check, there's the danger that you start customizing the software and you start branching it. And before you know it, you're almost more of a professional services shop than a product company. And although I don't think we went that far, there was always a danger that we were being less than efficient because the software was often being customized for each of these companies. It was a long sales cycle as well, so we did manage to scale. We did manage to get the profitability. We did manage to grow the team, so I think we grew from, in the very early days, we grew from 4 or 5 people to maybe 15 people, and we had about 150 customers at the height of it. But the business was still, it wasn't taking off the way we wanted it to. So this was still a...
So hold on, Alan, I have one question before you move on from this stage to the next.
Sure.
In this time frame, in the, let's say, 2001 to maybe 2005 time frame, you essentially pivoted from B2C to B2B, and it took you a good 3 to 5 years to find product market fit. How did you sustain during those years, both financially and emotionally? Obviously, once the enterprise customers kicked in gear, the cash was coming from them, and you, as you said, that was a very easy decision to pivot because they were the paying customers. But leading up to that, how did you sustain? Were you self-financing? Was it friends and family money? How did you get that far?
Sure, it's an important thing to chat about. So we did do a very, very small friends and family round when we first started the company. So this was in 2001, 2002. But really that funding had been exhausted by the time we pivoted into the enterprise. So we were selling. That was probably the best source of funding, and it's always the best source of funding. We obviously took very, very small salaries, and in many cases, in many months, myself and there was two other founders, we didn't take salary. So I think there's a lot of and those were the right decisions, to sort of go in and out of salary while you're trying to figure this out. You obviously don't have a fundable business yet. And if you don't have a fundable business, then you can't expect to go out and raise financing. You can't expect to get a lot of capital in. So you need to make sacrifices yourself. So we took very small salaries, and they were intermittent at best. The other thing that we did is we went out and we worked with local business development agencies, so government agencies, funding agencies, where they fund research and development, they fund commercialization of products. So this was a very meaningful amount of debt or grant funding that we were able to get. And it's non-equity based, but that certainly allowed us to move forward, you know, as we tried to figure out what the product market fit was. And then with every year, you know, we continually saw ourselves getting more and more customers. The other thing that was important was that even in 2004, for better or for worse, and this is not brilliance on our part, we chose an annual recurring revenue model. So as our base grew, of course, so did our recurring revenues. So that was something that was very valuable, and it really helped with cash flows and the sustainability of the business.
So the enterprise pivot got you to about 150 customers, but it still was not growing at the pace that you said you wanted to. What kind of revenue level did you get to with these 150 customers, and in what time frame?
Well, I mean, so we got to about $1 million in revenue, you know, sometimes just shy of it, sometimes more, but it really wasn't accelerating as we had wanted it to. And it's frustrating because it took us a long time. It took us basically 6 years where we realized that this business is not going to move in the speed and with the velocity as we had expected it to. And what's frustrating is that while the business is growing and while your customers are saying that they love your product, there's not quite enough of them to say this is a breakout success, but there's not quite too few of them to tell you that this is not worth it. So you're really in this middle ground of a product and a business model that has mediocre success. And I think those are among the most difficult things that any entrepreneur you know, has to deal with is mediocre success. Do you continue investing, or do you say that we need to pivot and move on to something else?
Right. So you arrived at a second pivot juncture, it sounds like. What was that second pivot?
So the second pivot was largely, and so the easy thing to say, the second pivot was around the cloud, moving to the cloud. But that actually wouldn't be telling the whole story. So the real second pivot was more about the business model and the target audience. So I'll tell you how that happened. So we had a very large insurance company as one of our desktop clients, and they loved our product. They used it you know, every single day to monitor real-time business metrics. But in 2010, this is when the iPad came out, they approached us and they said, all of our executives are running around with their new iPads. So they had a request. Can you make it work on mobile devices? And can you put it into the cloud? So that was their product request. But then they had two other requests as well. So, and those are more important. They said, can you make sure that we don't have to work with IT as much anymore? So the business, we want to manage our own dashboards. We want to build our own dashboards and visualizations. Can you make sure that we don't have to be as reliant on IT? So in other words, make the product more self-serve and easier to use. And the second thing they asked, and I had to laugh about it, and they said, can you make it less expensive? Or can you make it cheap? And I did think it was a funny thing. A customer, you know, obviously they're always going to ask to make it less expensive. But the brilliance of their question was, can you make it so that we don't have to work with IT and with procurement and
procurement.
Legal? So again, this entire idea was we want autonomy. We want to build our own dashboards and we want to acquire and pay for our own dashboards. We want to just be nimble and agile as much as possible. So really the pivot had more to do with the business model than with moving into the cloud. So we did all of those things, of course. We moved into the cloud. We made a mobile application. But we changed the business model significantly. We went from selling deals that were 25K and up to a licensing model that started at $20 a month or $24 a month. So very inexpensive as a first starting point. And when we launched this new product in the cloud with this new business model, we found that the self-serve buying process of this credit card type transaction got us 350 customers in the first year. And I only spoke to maybe 50% of them. So I was the sole salesperson at that time. So we had something that all of a sudden felt like it had some product market fit. And then the next year, we grew to 11.
How were these 350 people finding you, customers finding you?
Yeah, so we had, ever since our beginning, we have invested very heavily in search engine optimization and in content marketing. So we definitely had a huge asset that we were now able to leverage to go out and get leads. So if you search for sales dashboards or marketing dashboards or KPI examples, you know, we usually show up as number one or at least in the top three. So we had a tremendous amount of inbound search activity. And of course, with this price point and being in the cloud, we had all of a sudden opened up the market, not just to the enterprise, but we had opened it up to this SMB, the small and mid-sized business market. So we had, now we had grown our market tremendously. All of a sudden, it was a global market of close to 50 million companies. So that, along with the fact that it was easier to use, easier to buy, and the price point, was really the next pivot. That was the next big thing that changed the trajectory of the business.
And what year was that?
That was, so they approached us in 2010, and then in 2012, we launched our cloud dashboard, the product that we currently have. And it was really 2012 that was this new generation of the company and a new generation of the product. But at its core, it's still a real-time dashboard. It is still true to our original vision that real-time and frequently changing information should be serviced to an end user.
So it's 11 years after you started that you hit a high-velocity product market fit.
Yes, I know, which is in some regards absolutely crazy. But on the other hand, I actually think
it's not uncommon.
Exactly, and I think there's this misconception that companies get born and hit this stride right away, and that's not the case.
It's very rarely the case.
Yeah, even if you look at some of the most successful companies like New Relic or Atlassian or Shopify here in town, they have a long stretch where there's basically almost no growth. They're really trying to figure out the market and the target audience and the fit.
Yeah.
So I don't think ours is uncommon. It did feel like a long time, but I don't think it's uncommon.
And how many customers do you have now?
So we've just crossed, earlier this week, we just crossed 8,000 customers. So again, these are mostly small and mid-sized companies, but we also have departments within some of the larger organizations. And again, these are folks that know that they need to monitor their business better in real time. And to date, they simply have struggled with that. So the company has grown very quickly over the past 4 years.
And what did you do in 2016 revenue-wise?
We did, so ARR was close to $6 million.
$6 million. So by the time you found your product market fit, though, there were other players in the market like Tableau, you know, in the visualization space. What did you experience from the competitive challenge point of view?
So from a market point of view, we actually didn't face a tremendous amount of competitive challenge. So what we're finding is that, and I think this is very true for the small and mid-sized business market, is that oftentimes customers won't engage in a very thorough competitive analysis. SMBs don't generally do RFPs. what we're finding is that the buying behavior is really that they find a vendor, and whatever that first vendor is, they will start a trial, and then if they like what they see, they will continue. So we find that the competitive pressures within SMB are less than in an enterprise buying scenario. I'll tell you though where we did see competitive pressure, and that was when we were doing our funding. Really the fact that we play within the business intelligence space, and that is a very crowded space, probably 100 different competitors, 100 different vendors. I think that's where we saw the most fears and the most confusion about how the market is segmented.
So let's talk about funding. After 12 years of bootstrapping, you raised a couple of rounds of funding. Tell us more about the rounds and your, you know, accelerated growth in customer metrics. How, you know, at what point did you raise the first round of funding, with what metrics, from whom, and how did you decide whom to raise from and how to raise? And similarly, what were the metrics of Series B, from whom, how much, et cetera?
Sure, absolutely. So to sort of circle back, in our first year, we had 350 customers after launching. Then we had 1,100 customers. And that's at the point where we said to ourselves, we think we have something here that is scaling. And there's a feeling that you get when you have product market fit. And this is a feeling that we never had before. In all of our 10 years, we never felt that real incredible pull. So we were feeling this in 2013, 2014, we were starting to feel this pull. So at the beginning of 2014, we raised a seed round. And really that came together because we brought together a small group of folks, one person notably, and we said, hey, listen, this is what's happening in the business. We think we may have something that is fundable. So should we continue growing through operations at what we think might be a 2x multiple for 2014, or should we accelerate and see if we can get a higher multiple, like a 3x a growth multiple, and go out and raise a seed round? So in hindsight, the decision was to go out and raise a seed round. We did that. We had actually amazing interest right from the start. We had a great lead here in town, the Business Development Bank of Canada. They led, and then we put together a number of other players as well that participated. Probably the most important player in that whole mix was somebody by the name of Rob Ash. Rob is the past CEO of Cognos, and he's now, and Cognos is based in Ottawa, so we're very fortunate to have that talent pool here, and Rob as well. But Rob saw right through the competitive market, through the competitive landscape, and said, listen, if you can build a company, a business intelligence company, that is targeting the small and mid-sized market, that's the market where there's tremendous amount of opportunity, and right now it's completely barren. There are no competitors, no vendors that are targeting that space. So our seed round investors liked the growth, the early growth that we were seeing, and then Rob was instrumental in helping allay those fears about a competitive space. So that was really how that round came together. And I think the first significant metric that we were looking at was really our growth, our early growth, so early evidence that this was a market that was raising their hand and had a real need. So that was in 2014. We raised that, or we announced our seed round, and it was a $1.6 million seed round that we raised in January of 2014. We put that money to use, and we actually did, in fact, grow the business with a 3x multiple on the previous year. Which was very, very positive, because what we did then is we went out to market again, and at the beginning of 2015, again, January, February of 2015, we raised our A round. Now, the A round, again, we had all the right metrics. We had positive dollar retention. So our customers were buying more than the folks that were churning or downgrading. We had, you know, good logo churn numbers. We had phenomenal MRR growth, you know, 3x on an annual basis. So we had all the right metrics to really have a strong fundraise. But again, we found that the investors were struggling with two things. One was the fact that the market was very crowded. So again, we had to really educate them on the ability to stratify and break this into the enterprise and then the small and mid-sized business market. But even after we sort of did that, there was a whole swath of investors and VCs that were scared about going after small and mid-sized business. So the legacy, I think that the bulk of investors out there have traditionally, you know, funded companies that are in the enterprise space. And consumer and SMB is often something that's left to some niche players, and, you know, very successful niche players, but it's not the norm. So we had a number of discussions around that as well, making sure that folks were comfortable with SMB.
And you did everything from Ottawa, Canada. What was that experience like, and how would you, you know, characterize entrepreneurship, especially the latter part of your entrepreneurship journey, where you were raising money and so forth, doing that from Ottawa? Was that, what would you call as the pros and cons?
So it's a good question, because in our early years, you know, Ottawa has always had a tech culture. I mean, it's a government town as well, being the capital of Canada, but it's always had a strong tech culture as well. So lots of good universities. However, it really has only been in the past couple of years that we've seen this resurgence again of Ottawa as being a hub. I think Shopify has helped with that, Kinaxis, Halogen here in town, the recent investment of Google and Apple and QNX into town as well. So there's a real thriving ecosystem in Ottawa. I think it's probably one of the best in the country. And certainly from a loyalty point of view, from access to capital point of view, we haven't seen any issues. But the story has two sides, and I think it's human nature, because in our early years, before we had any funding, we often found it was difficult to get an audience. And it is human nature. Folks want to associate themselves with companies that are taking off, with people that are successful, and dissociate themselves with the opposite. So, you know, it's hard, because as an entrepreneur who's trying to find market fit, you don't have the evidence or the proof yet. You often exist within this vacuum of you don't get any media attention. You know, you don't get any funding attention. So it's very, very difficult. And you need to get that breakthrough and that evidence. And then all of a sudden, you're the darling of the town. So it can change very, very quickly. So, I mean, it's always something that, again, I think entrepreneurs have these dreams of being sort of the center and you know, being able to attract media attention and investment. And there's a lot of hard work and investment and evidence that is required before any of that happens.
So the mantra of the 1M1M program is bootstrap first, raise money later. And a corollary of that is VCs like to come to the rescue of victory. And the same is true for the media, by the way. We kind of do a lot of work in the, you know, grassroots level of really working with entrepreneurs who are bootstrapping and who are in the early stages and so forth. But the bulk of the media and the bulk of the investment community want things that are fleshed out, that have achieved product market fit, and in the case of the media, that actually have funding. The favorite types of stories that the media likes to cover are funding stories. So it's kind of unfortunate, because over 99% of the entrepreneurs out there never get funding, actually. They're definitely, they're constantly getting rejected by investors, and part of the reason is because they haven't reached that high-velocity product market fit that is required for venture capital funding. And there's tremendous lack of understanding of these factors in the ecosystem. And we've been probably the company that has consistently tried to, you know, debunk these stupid myths that are floating around in the industry that entrepreneurship equals financing. Our philosophy is entrepreneurship equals revenues, customers' revenues and profits, essentially.
Yeah. The best way to get funding is to sell to somebody something that proves to be valuable. That is hands down the best. And I'm always thrilled to find companies where they have bootstrapped and really raised almost no capital. Maybe they have bootstrapped it with some debt, or maybe they've bootstrapped it with a small friends and family round. But you know, you can grow a company very successfully without taking any equity-based financing. So it's not exclusive to one another. I think that's important to understand as well.
Yeah. All right. Well, Alan, thank you very much for sharing your wonderful story. And what I really like about your story is also that it's a story of persistence. You know, it took you a long time to hit your stride, hit kind of this high velocity product market fit. And the message to all of those who are listening to this session is that it is important to keep working at it and keep chipping away at how to essentially chisel your eventual, you know, masterpiece. And that requires a lot of time, patience, resilience, creativity. You have to constantly look for opportunities for whether it's pivot or whether it's slight course correction or, you know, new experiments. And that's just the reality of how businesses get built.